Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 58 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, and her life. Oh boy, today we're talking about how much sex you should have. Was that you? Did you just fall off the chair? Yeah, I told you that. How much sex you should have. Oh my goodness. Well, we've got some research behind this, some really cool data. So hold on to your hat on this one. But before we start the episode, just know that it's made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They're delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix customized for women. You won't forget to take them because they taste so great. To learn more, please hop on over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And a quick reminder to run on over to iTunes after our episode and give us a nice review and a rating, because we want to hear from you. And yeah, I actually read these things. Wipe the shock off your face. I do. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind, her body, her life. It's all about her.
How much sex should you have? Well, you know what I do. You know my reputation. I'm a physician and a scientist. I sure do like that good science. So we've got a wonderful expert on board, Dr. Mary Andrus, who is a PhD professor in the Rossier School of Education at the University of Southern California and the co-coordinator of the Marriage and Family Therapy Program. Very well known, very renowned. Now, she's a licensed clinical psychologist, has a private practice in Venice, California, and she specializes in couples therapy, sexuality, and identity concerns. And her courses in the Masters of Marriage and Family Therapy program address sexuality counseling skills, family systems, and couples therapy. She's a past president of the USC Advisory Board for the LGBT Center and was a co-president and board member of the USC Lambda Alumni Association. And she presents all over the place talking about these same issues, this whole issue of sexuality, this issue of identity. So let's just hop right to it. Dr. Mary Andrus, welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be joining you today, and I love this topic.
I know. Well, duh. You know, why do you think we ran on over and abducted you so you could talk about this? You know, recently in USA Today, there was a story. It was really got a whole lot of social media spin. How often should you have sex? You know, and what is this partner sex therapy counseling thing all about? You know, people are just having issues. They're talking about, well, for instance, how much sex a couple should have. Some 40-year study that surveyed more than 30,000 Americans found in 2015 that couples who have sex once a week are the happiest. Oh my gosh, there went 50 Shades of Grey. So should couples put a number on how often they hop in the bed? All right, let's set the whole record straight. What are some of the reasons couples will go to someone like you to address challenges in their sex lives?
One of the biggest reasons is just that between a couple, they have different ideas about what is enough and what's the kind of sex that they want to be having. So it could be specifically around sex as the primary topic, or a lot of times couples aren't very good at talking about sex, so they come in talking about some other kind of conflict or just not getting along very well, but invariably two or three sessions in, sex is on the table, front and center, as this is part of our connection or our communication, and we're not having it or we're not satisfied with it.
Huh. All right. And, you know, one of the things that I feel that I've seen, certainly working with people, is that this is a really tough topic sometimes for a couple to even broach. You know, because, you know, there are a lot of funky feelings that are going on here. What are those funky feelings?
Well, sometimes just depending on culturally how we're brought up in families. When I'm teaching therapists in training, what I asked them, were you raised in a sex positive, negative, or neutral household? Meaning, like, if there was a sex scene on television, did your parents freak out and turn it off? Like, is this a taboo topic?
Delete.
Delete. Exactly. You know, how uncomfortable was it? Did you get good information or did you get mixed information? And then even seeing parents and other kind of adult role models in your life when you're a kid, were they affectionate with each other? Did you have a sense that they were intimate, not in a creepy way, but in a healthy, like, I know my parents really love each other, or I see these other role models of mine, and sexuality is a healthy, natural part of their identities and their lives. And a lot of us didn't have that.
Yeah. You think? I mean, I'm thinking to myself when I was growing up, Lord, if something, you know, hit the tube, or if we were at the movies or something and suddenly we're doing, you know, there's like a sex scene or something close to it, I was slinking down in my seat if I was with my parents going, oh, please, God, let this be over. It was just uncomfortable because, you know, we were a good, you know, Catholic family. We don't talk about things like that. And I just think that it's also highly generational too, don't you think?
I do think. And what we have now with kind of people exposed to so much technology in the millennial generation and kids who have been exposed to pornographic images from a very young age, there's a lot of information coming in sometimes before there's the emotional development to really make sense of it. And there's always been kind of bravado talk in the locker room where people are bragging and they're talking about things that are beyond the scope of their real experience. But to have those kinds of authentic conversations and really be able to communicate well with a partner, most of us have not had the kind of role models or even kind of classroom or family discussions where there's a kind of a vocabulary for discussing sex. And many times the therapist is the first person with a couple to give permission to, let's talk about this. Let's ask follow-up questions. Let's be curious and try to hear each other in a non-blaming or a non-avoidant way, but to move toward each other to be able to talk about sexuality.
Interesting, interesting. And, you know, so it's sort of a safety zone where they can, you know, it's like the cone of safety or something falls over them, and now they can really actually have a conversation. I think that your role as a therapist and all the people that you train, you know, have a very, very valuable a place in someone's life when it's really difficult to open the conversation about this. I think a lot of guys are kind of machismo, and they're like, you know, if they're having issues, especially as they get older, then it makes them really uncomfortable, and it's awkward because they feel like it falls on them, like it's their fault. Meanwhile, women are having body, you know, image issues, and they're thinking, well, you know, if we're not having it that often, or if there's like a number assigned to it and it's not happening or back and forth, it's because, you know, I'm too fill in the blank, right? Too fat, too, you know, whatever the issue may be. And so you've got all of this going on. And I think that this is where therapy could really help bring it all together. Don't you think?
Oh, very much so. I think that a lot of times people avoid uncomfortable conversations. They, especially if you're very good at sports or you're good at your job or you're good at doing other tasks, it's much easier to, let me just go over here where I shine, instead of having to navigate in an area where I feel inadequate or insufficient, or I worry about disappointing you, or I worry about being criticized. And so that avoidance can be so automatic for people. And to be able to kind of be softened and coached out of that avoidant place takes somebody sometimes in that cone to really make that a safe environment and to show the other partner, this is what non-critical kind of conversation looks like. This is how you approach somebody who might be afraid or avoidant, or this is how you might soften someone who is being critical so that they can talk about what's underneath that, which is a lot of times being scared of rejection. You know, it's like, are we not being intimate because you don't love me anymore?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of that, you know, leaping to conclusions things, only to find out that maybe someone is stressed out of their brains about, you know, a job deadline or an expectation in their profession or something funky that happened in the family, and they're just distracted. They're not there.
Right,
you have to be there. You have to be present to make all of this work, and this could be a problem. So.
Yeah.
I think that is really cool. So you know, when someone is all obsessed about, you know, they've been watching the trailers for 50 Shades, you know, part deux or whatever. What is it? Part two, three, four? I don't know. I've lost count out there. And they're wondering, gosh, you know, that's not my life. I think a lot of that type of hype, especially what you see in the media, does that confuse people? Does that make people a little crazy out there as they try to figure out how it works for themselves?
Yeah, it does. I mean, there's the whole FOMO, fear of missing out. And so when you see images like that, it's kind of like, is that what I'm supposed to be doing? And it does set up a lot of insecurities. What we find, and this is, again, the influence of technology and the media, is people are so often comparing their real lives to the curated lives or the edited lives or the Photoshop lives of everybody else. And that's where you get those kind of dissatisfaction with one's body. That's where you get this kind of comparative feeling of insecurity that you think you should be having sex multiple times a week because that's what you saw in a film or that's what you're reading in erotica or something. And the reality is that each one of us has our own level of our energy, our priorities, the demands on us. And it's not so much about frequency, but it's about finding within the relationship what is nourishing, you know, what is nourishing for the relationship. Sexuality is as much a part of our lives as our health, as our rest, as our, you know, staying hydrated, as our kind of spirituality or our kind of mental focus. I mean, it's one of those areas that I think can get dropped off too easily unless somebody says, hey, how do we keep this a priority? You know, this is just as relevant to us as eating well.
Well, let me ask you an interesting question. I was posed this by a really lovely woman, one of my patients, and she said, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. You know, I need to know, as we've gotten older, and this is, she is about 59 and her husband's about 65.
Mm-hmm.
We have come to appreciate our own sense of connectiveness through hugging and cuddling and cocooning and kissing, but there's not a whole lot of sexual intercourse.
Uh-huh.
And she, you know, and she looked at me and she said, you know, is that weird? Is that abnormal? Should we be having like physical intercourse as well? Because we sort of like it the way it is and it just sort of works. So tell me where this fits in.
That's wonderful because, first of all, I love that she approached you and just asked, you know, am I okay?
Yeah.
And that, because the first part of sex therapy sometimes is just permission. You know, it's permission to ask for what you want or it's permission to ask for information. And that people just want validation. And limited information is the second step sometimes. It's like, am I normal? The part that is lovely about your patient and her husband are that they are in agreement. That's what makes a difference. In that situation, that's not a couple that would show up in my office because there's no dissonance between them. The challenge is if somebody is 59 and they're saying, you know what, I am through menopause, I'm, you know, figuring this stuff out. I love to cuddle, I love to be close, but I just don't have the energy to really go at it like we used to. And their partner is still feeling very restless and saying, I really feel disconnected from you if we're not being intimate. Then those are the couples where they need to have those conversations and figure out a way of finding their way back to each other. But even
I love that whole thing. It sounds like, you know, really an ongoing dynamic journey of staying connected.
Absolutely.
I mean, is that simplifying it too much or what?
No, because what the research show is that young people have more sex in terms of frequency, but older people have greater quality in their sex life. You know, they're having a better sexual quality of life. And a lot of that has to do with it's not being about frequency, but about being that kind of connection. There's a sexual exploration and a focus on your partner's pleasure, which is very different than this is something I need to feel okay, which is more of the younger person's version of it.
Interesting. So do you think, you know, speaking of generational issues, do you think that younger people who are doing the whole hookup thing, you slide to the right or whatever that is.
Tinder, yeah.
The whole Tinder thing. So how is that changing up this conversation about, you know, sex and connectiveness? Because that's a very different thing that's going on now than, say, for someone who is now 50. So if you look at a 20, 25-year-old and someone twice that age, how is this changing up the landscape of what sexuality and sexual connectiveness is really about?
Great question. Part of it is that I think in some ways, younger people are able to navigate and talk about sex more directly. They're able to say what they want and what they don't want. I think there's still some miscommunication for young people, some misunderstandings in those situations, but there's more of a sexual competency in some ways. That doesn't mean there's more of an intimacy competency, because sometimes with the whole idea of hookup culture, there's almost like an emotional shutting off. So there's the oxytocin high of having sex, and there's this false sense of closeness, but it's not a genuine sense of closeness that you can trust. You know, it's like taking drugs and feeling kind of a sense of calm and ease and safety, but you're not really calm and safe. And oxytocin.
Well, you don't have a sustainable connection either.
Right,
because,
exactly.
You know, if it's a one-night hookup or whatever the issue may be, I mean, you may never see that person again.
Exactly. So you're practicing. So there's a lot of rehearsal in terms of your sexual skills, potentially, in those situations. So maybe when people get to more committed relationships, at one level, they're able to verbalize better around the topic of sexuality, and that makes them different from a generation that didn't grow up with a sexual vocabulary. But it doesn't necessarily make them better at intimacy, which is that capacity to be vulnerable, to ask for your needs being met, to be able to navigate through difficult dialogue with someone.
Is this going to end up being a problem?
What'd you say?
Is this going to be a problem as they get older?
It can be. The problem is the threshold of, can I tolerate things being uncomfortable? And when you have Tinder and something's not going well, you can always just swipe again. You know, it's instead of working through difficult conversations with a partner, you think, oh, this is too hard. There's plenty of fish in the sea. Let me just go out again and find a new partner. So you always are great at the startups, but you're not great at the follow-through, you know, and the really that middle ground of what is it like to be in a relationship where all the shiny newness is worn off and now you're dealing with kind of real life together. So that, I think, is one of those challenges for people that have too many options in their 20s.
All right. So one of the things that I really want to make sure to touch on is something that you've talked about, and that is the issue of technology and its impact on relationships. So, you know, you're about ready to, you know, connect with someone, but you're still scoping your Twitter and your Facebook and maybe your email, and, you know, maybe you're ready to do an Instagram too. I mean, what does that mean? What is the role of technology here? What should it be? What shouldn't it be?
Well, what it can be, technology can work in our favor and it can work against us. So for a couple, let's say, that has a super busy life, and one of the undercurrents are, do you love your job? Do you love your kids? Do you love whatever else more than you love me? Because we have ways of sending people messages during the day and being able to text or send, just send a meme or something to connect, the technology can work in terms of more communication. Sometimes that backfires. Part of the immediate gratification problem is people expect immediate turnaround, which is different than when you used to leave a message on somebody's answering machine and they would call you back they got home from work. So it's very different, that immediate gratification problem. And so if somebody's not feeling satisfied in their current relationship, that access to so many others can actually be a threat to the stability of good relationships. So you have that external threat of people seeking validation outside of their primary relationships. And that's where the old sweethearts from Facebook, your high school reunion folks looking you up again because they're bored and restless. They're not talking to their partners. They're reaching out for, another person. Those can be threats. So that's
How
one threat. The other threat is that sometimes we're all too addicted to our devices, and the devices are actually becoming these barriers between couples and intimacy. So part of the thing that I've been addressing with couples a lot are having habits where they turn off the TV at night, where they're not just falling asleep in front of screens, but they're really taking the time to have that quality, intimate connection with each other. And that doesn't have to be sex, but it does have to be, two people really creating that space to be with each other, whether it's in conversation or whether it's the cuddling or the spooning like you were talking about, or just telling stories, but not just passively consuming technology.
Well, I see it all the time, and I know that you do. You're the expert in the field, and that is, even if you go to dinner, and somebody's just, flipping around on their cell phone while the other person's just sort of waiting for them to kind of like connect. It's like, hello, I'm here. I'm sitting here waving, and just being able to have someone be present. You can't be present, if you're flipping through your cell phone. It just doesn't work. And yet I see it all the time. And Lord, the other day I saw, a couple, both of them were at it, and neither of them ever connected with their eyes.
Exactly.
I'm like, wait a minute, stop. I'm on to run over there and do like an intervention or something. Of course, I get my ass suit or something. But I mean, I was like, can you guys look at each other for just, those famous 36 questions that you ask, it's made the New York Times
from
thing.
The New York Times,
and that guy's research, I forgot his name. And, what you have to do while you're asking those 36 questions as you're getting to know someone is you have to stare at someone directly in the eye.
Yeah.
And you have to do it for a certain number of minutes. It's freaky. It's like, when's the last time you did that?
That's intimacy. That's the intimacy that a lot of people who have grown up with phones and screens aren't comfortable with. You're exactly
right.
And we do prescribe putting your phone away. There's research that said even if your phone is face down on the table, the other person across from you is not going to trust you as much as if you put your phone away. If your phone is off the table, in your jacket or in your purse, off, but out of sight. Because you're communicating that my attention is on you. When your device is there, when the device is on the table, when the device is gone, when the device is on the table, you're saying, I'm paying attention to you until I get interrupted.
Or what's even worse is, let's just say someone comes into the room, it's a couple living together, whatever. Uh-huh. And you just say, hey, can I talk to you about something? And they say, yes, but they never get their eyes off the screen. You're like, wait a minute. Put your eyes over here and look at me. Hello. I count, I count. And that's what it's all about. I just think this thing with technology showed up with no handbook. You know, it just sort of like reared its head. And it's marvelous. I mean, technology's great. There's no question about that. But it's only great if you understand the limits and boundaries of how it's used. And I think that that's something that we're kind of muddling through right now. And thanks to your marvelous research and the work that you do, we're getting a better handle on the fact that, no, there's no great number of sexual encounters that you need every week, month, year, or whatever to be able to hit nirvana, that it's really about facilitating a conversation between two people, you know, partners, couples, married, who the hell cares? It doesn't matter. Just
right.
Two people who could look at each other and have a conversation about what they need and about what works best for both of them, and with the expectation that it may take a while to kind of do a little trial and error and play around with it, and that people are on their own journeys here and they're not supposed to be little, you know, mirror images of one another. And everyone just needs to get realistic about this. I want everyone out there to make certain to run on over to Dr. Mary Andresses, and that's A-N-D-R-E-S, wonderful work as professor in the Rossier School of Education at the University of Southern California, where she is the co-coordinator of the Marriage and Family Therapy Program. This is wonderful work that you do as a researcher. We all thank you so much, Dr. Andress, for your words of wisdom, because I think a lot of women out there in her podcast land are heaving a collective sigh of relief. Whew, we thought there was a number. There is no number. It's just all about communication. Give us one last word of wisdom before we part on this wonderful Her podcast.
Yeah, sure. In the same way, I think our whole culture is shifting to like slow food movement. Slow intimacy movement is also important. This whole fast and easy isn't as satisfying as us really investing in quality. And quality relationships, quality sex, that's where it's at.
I love it. And with those parting words, thank you, Dr. Andress, for this wonderful segment on how much sex should you have? How provocative is that? Hey, everyone out there, remember to catch every episode of Her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com. And please take some time after this segment and rate this podcast on iTunes. We want to read your review and your rating because it means a lot to us. Your feedback means everything. Plus, I love to read these. Hey, I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD. And you can also check out our Her Show page at RadioMD.com for all of our past episodes. Thanks for listening and stay well.